Many communities around the country have a sense of musical identity. Down south, house music is very popular. The West Coast has a strong alternative music scene. What about Central New York? Is jazz alive and well in the 315? We'll discuss it this week on the 315.
On-demand audio on WAER is supported by SRC Incorporated, headquartered in Syracuse, New York. SRC is actively hiring engineers and other positions. Learn more at srcinc.com/careers.
Larry Blumenfeld will serve as the 2019 Jeanette K. Watson Distinguished Visiting Professor in the Humanities at Syracuse University. He is a culture reporter, music critic, and lecturer who writes regularly for the Wall Street Journal and has contributed to many newspapers, magazines, scholarly essay collections, and websites. His work focuses on jazz and Afro-Latin music and on the intersections between culture, politics, and activism.
Larry, thanks so much for chatting with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here.
So as we dive into our conversation today, let's sort of outline your time that's going to be spent here. Your residency is called Jazz in Troubled Times. Briefly, sort of unpack maybe some of the themes you're hoping to discuss during your time here.
Okay, yeah. I'm here for 2 weeks, and really it's exciting to me that I'm doing this residency through the Humanities Center. And I've organized lectures, presentations, workshops, roundtable discussions, and musical performances that really embrace the whole university community, various different schools, various different constituencies. And that's very intentional. So it's exciting to me that I can come and talk about the idea of jazz in the with the platform of the Humanities Center and really reach out in all the directions that the music and the culture naturally reach. I'm calling this Jazz in Troubled Times, and we could sit here and argue or discuss what jazz isn't, whether a certain kind of music is jazz or isn't. We could sit here and talk about what, argue or discuss what we mean by troubled times. But I'm kind of looking at both ends of that equation and how they relate. So jazz as a music, as a style, as a form, as an idea, certainly came up because of and in the context of troubled times roughly a century ago. I'd argue that we're living in very distinctly troubled times right now. And without going into detail, what I mean by that is certain divisiveness, a certain amount of tension over long simmering conflicts regarding race, regarding inequity, sometimes regarding gender, regarding ideas about identity. And so, well, how does our idea of jazz and our idea of troubled times relate? What does the music and the culture have to say or to do about these troubled times? And the subtitle that I gave this was The Relevance and Resonance of a Culture. It's interesting because I know your little intro mentioned, hey, is jazz still alive in the 315? And Syracuse happens to be one community in this country that had a very interesting history and presence of jazz and of blues and other kinds of music and of visual arts. And those things never die. They never go away. Now, is a jazz musician going to have a hit on the radio playing nationally and sell hundreds of thousands of copies of their album or millions? I don't know that that's happening today. But I'm here to talk about a culture that is still vital, is still strong, is still important in many places, including a place like this, and certainly within any modern university.
So you mentioned that jazz is born in a sense of troubled times, and there's examples throughout history of musicians and artists reflecting what's happening in contemporary society mm-hmm. within their music. Go back to Billie Holiday and Strange Fruit. We can go back to Nina Simone and Mississippi Goddamn. We can go to John Coltrane and Alabama. Do we see any of that today from some of today's artists reflecting what's happening in our contemporary society?
Absolutely. There's no question about that. Especially if you talk to the musicians the way that I do. There, you know, along with the long history of great music is a long history of these musicians speaking both through song titles and in overt ways, but also in interviews and other ways. So you have Louis Armstrong telling a reporter how badly Eisenhower is treating his people when the school integration crisis was going on in Arkansas. You have Terrence Blanchard, another trumpeter from New Orleans, who just was nominated for an Academy Award for the score to Spike Lee's movie. And he has created the score for these very politically, socially loaded messages. And one of the things one of the lectures I'll be giving about New Orleans focuses mostly on the period since the floods resulting from the levee failures after Katrina. And one of the main characters in that story is Terrence Blanchard, who has been very forceful in approaching those issues. But absolutely. I think in the past several years, that's been true of artists in this country in general. But when you've got a form of music, a form of culture that naturally reflects African-American reality, no matter who's playing it, no matter what the orientation of the person, that is naturally rooted in that stuff and that has always been a very sophisticated mixture of messages. So, yeah, you could listen to Sonny Rollins' Freedom Suite as just music, or you could read his liner notes. So I don't think that has waned in any way. And part of that is just simply in legacy.
Mm-hmm. Dive a little deeper into what you were just talking about with regard to New Orleans. Give us some examples of how musicians are, reflecting the culture or addressing New Orleans culture and politics after Katrina.
So, yeah, among there's maybe eight different public events that I'm doing while I'm here. One is a lecture that I'm calling Armstrong in Prison, The Fight for New Orleans Jazz Culture Since the Flood. And I've spent a good deal of the past decade or so reporting from New Orleans and researching that and writing about it. And part of my message there is that there's this storied and famous jazz culture of New Orleans that the city sells itself with and that we all sort of know and honor, but a lot of people think of it as either history or as a very interesting culture to consume while you're there. What I realized and what anyone who's immersed in that knows is that this is a part of the essential fabric of life in New Orleans, and there are elements of it: traditional jazz, brass band-led parades, second-line parades, Mardi Gras Indian culture that are flamboyant and wonderful. But for instance, in 2006, say, when I went down to, I was writing a piece for the Village Voice at the time, I went down there, and if you looked at these second-line parades that people were organizing with brass bands leading them through essentially rubble and devastation. Many of these people had come back, weren't even back yet living in New Orleans, had come in. It looked like, hey, it's really cool that these people can celebrate in the face of disaster. It's really good that they want to have a good time despite the despair. But really what that was a very political, it was a political action to say, these are our streets. This is how we assert our right to return and the fact that this is our home, even though we have been somewhat, I think the story has been well told about how disenfranchised many of those people mm-hmm. were. And at the same time, when a congressman was saying, hey, maybe we ought to bulldoze the whole joint.
Now, on Tuesday, April 2nd, you're going to give a talk called How Does Jazz Survive and Thrive? And when we hear those two options there, survival and thriving, that almost seems to indicate that the current state of jazz is in one of two places. Is it closer to needing to survive or having the ability to thrive, or is it not an either-or question?
I don't think it's an either-or question. I was invited by the Setner School of Music and their Sawyer's lecture series, which is geared toward music business, to participate. And I'm going to have a conversation with Larry Luttinger, who I think has been responsible for a great deal of jazz presentation and organization that's empowered musicians in this area. And I've gone to enough industry conferences and sat in enough panel discussions where people wring their hands and like, how can we make everyone love jazz again? How can we put jazz back on everyone's radio again, even though I think it's all about downloads now. And I don't like those conversations. And those days are gone, and that's not necessarily – I don't want to be a rah-rah booster for jazz. Yes, I love this music. If you come over to my house, I will play it for you. But what I mean to talk about there is, what does a sustainable jazz culture look like, and how do you do that? So if thriving means having a Billboard hit – no. If thriving means having communities and an infrastructure where kids are exposed to jazz and learn about jazz, where jazz musicians are regularly working, making a sustainable living, and having their music reach into a wider world, yes, that's what I want to talk about. I think, you know, the music business as I once knew it, as we once knew it, is gone also. It's exploded into a million shards. I think unless you're Beyonce or another huge star, you're really only talking about niche audiences, and you're really only talking about this constellation of things. So in a way, you know, 30 years ago, you wanted to be the next Wynton Marsalis. You wanted to be signed to Columbia Records or another big label, and you wanted to have that generate, a whole lot of great business realizations. That, by and large, does not happen anymore, and the music business isn't built for that anymore, and the download audience culture isn't built for that anymore either. That stuff isn't even that exciting or interesting to me, except there are so many ways in which jazz, the explosion, the bad news is that business is gone. The good news is that business is gone. So now there are ways that musicians actually have more control over their own music and what they're going to do with it. So I know a lot of musicians who are doing a lot of fascinating things. I know a lot of places where you can hear great music. Also, I could say, well, hey, yeah, Oscar-nominated film, a film score by a jazz composer. Hey, one of the best-watched late-night TV shows, Stephen Colbert Show, has a New Orleans jazz musician as its band leader, and he plays a lot of kinds of music, but there's jazz in there. Not long ago, sat at the Chamber Music America conference interviewing Henry Threadgill about the legacy of the AACM, which they were giving an award to. Henry Threadgill, a couple years ago, won the Pulitzer Prize for composition. So I have no doubt that jazz culture is thriving both in terms of reaching into the air of what our culture is and also creating opportunity. What I think I'm going to talk with Larry about at that seminar is, well, yeah, what does it mean? What does it mean to how, you know, if even if you don't have jazz clubs in your city, which many cities that used to don't anymore, how does jazz get presented?
Yeah,
how does
it that get, is the that's the sort of the big question for me is wondering without those platforms to be heard. So if you don't have radio, if you don't have traditional jazz clubs, if there aren't enough venues presenting, how does the culture get passed on to younger generations to support and and maintain. So are you seeing any creative things happening in other communities around the country?
Yes, I see. Well, first of all, you know, hey, we're in Syracuse, New York. Jazz does get played on the radio, thanks in large part to your station. Jazz does get presented here.
Well, you speak of Luttinger's organization, one that we partner with a lot, and there is pretty much year-round presentation of the music. So there's that effort. There are actually two jazz festivals here in the summers. So we kind of think we have a pretty rich tradition here.
There's definitely, you know, the questions you're asking are really interesting and good ones. But they, to me, they apply, I think, every cultural organization, every kind of culture, except for the most marketable ones, are asking those questions. And I think people's ways of experiencing culture are changing so dramatically as technology changes, as people's habits change. So that's where the confusion lies. But the music itself is fine. The creative life is fine. The last time I did go to a professional conference where they were talking about these sorts of things, something called a Jazz Action Committee, I just stood up and I said one word, community. And that's really the answer. Do you have communities? So, and that way I do lament the loss of many clubs, because what you need are communities where people somehow feel connected by an idea of a culture, an experience of a culture, and can hear music live. And in a small way, that's what I'm doing here at the university over 2 weeks, and creating a community of people, scholars, students, musicians, others, who want to approach the idea of jazz and the culture of jazz from all different perspectives, and we somehow connect, and then, yeah, we also experience great music live. Can I talk a little bit about the great music we're going to experience live?
Yeah, well, actually, we want to dive into some of the more interesting events that you're going to be having during your two-week stay.
We know on the Friday, April 5th, you're going to have a real exciting concert going on that night with Jason Moran, followed by a solo piano performance. For anyone who's sort of not familiar with Jason and his work, just tease that a little bit for us.
Okay.
As well as the title, Gangsterism on Campus, A Conversation About Jazz, Race, and Creative Intent.
Yes. So there's a famous Jean-Michel Basquiat painting, Hollywood Africans, and in the, which is probably his most famous work. And in that painting, among the many words scrawled on the canvas, is gangsterism. And Jason Moran, early in his career, just latched onto that word. And he's had a series of compositions throughout his career that all use the word gangsterism. One is called Gangsterism on Canvas, I think was the first one, Gangsterism. And so I'm playing off that, and they let me get away with it. And so gangsterism, and really I'm going to let Jason address, well, why did you grab that word and what's embedded in that word? And embedded in Basquiat's painting and his title, Hollywood Africans, are a lot of the contradictions and very layered issues of identity involved in being a black artist in the United States of America. And I think that's something that, as with many jazz musicians or musicians who come out of jazz, Jason's own work has dealt with those ideas. So for me, you know, when I started writing about jazz and doing the work I'm doing maybe 30 years ago, there was a question of, hey, is this relevant? Why am I doing this? Can this still be vital and relevant and of my time? And because some people at that moment thought that jazz was cool, but it needed to look and sound and feel like it did decades earlier. I think Jason Moran then and now is kind of exhibit A for me of a musician whose work and his style and the way he speaks about it says, yes, this is very much, I am rooted in all of this tradition, but I am not bound by it. And what I'm doing is vital. What I'm doing raises questions that are relevant today. Jason's a fascinating musician. He's a great pianist. He's a great band leader. He's a great composer. He also is, inherited the pianist Billy Taylor's position directing the jazz programs at the Kennedy Center. So he's someone who helps foster the very culture that you were asking me about. So Jason, we're going to sit in Hendricks Chapel, which is kind of a glorious environment. Mm-hmm. We're going to sit and talk about jazz, race, and creative intent. And by creative intent, there's sort of an existential question that I think was true of anything we call jazz from the beginning, but is very true of the visual artists and the musicians that are in Jason's community. And so, you know, what are those questions about, those existential questions of creative intent? When we're done talking, Jason's going to sit down at the grand piano and play solo piano, which I don't know how often he does that these days, and that's really, I'd want to come hear that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we touched on, Monday, April 1st, 5:30 to 7:30, Armstrong in Prison, the Fight for New Orleans Jazz Culture Since the Flood, and that's going to be in the Herg, the Joyce Hergenhan Auditorium at Newhouse 3. We touched on sort of what you were writing about.
Can we talk a little bit about Friday at La Casita?
Yes, let's talk about that one. This is Friday, March 29, 6:30 to 8:30. And it's La Conexión Cubana, the Cuban Connection, featuring Yasvani Terry Quartet in performance at La Casita. Tell us a little bit about that one.
So one of my missions, one of my many interrelated missions here in this residency is to really express the idea that jazz was multicultural from its start and has always contained the multicultural message that we struggle with today. It's one answer to understanding that equation. And it needs to be understood in a sweep of cultural influence throughout this hemisphere as a result of the African diaspora. It needs to be understood in terms of many, many influences having to do with Europe and the Far East and other things, but most primarily this diaspora, so that there's an inherent connection from the start with, when we talk about anything we'd call jazz culture, with South America, Central America, the Caribbean, and probably most prominently Cuba. Just because Cuba has been such an important source of culture and intellect, and because there was this, there's always been this direct link between the U.S. and Cuba. Now, when jazz was being formed in New Orleans, there was regular traffic back and forth over the water from New Orleans to Cuba. So that influence was direct and very intense. But even despite decades of what I would call a terribly ill-advised embargo that has sometimes shut down the musician's ability to physically connect, the relationship between the... So I guess what I'm saying here is that what I learned as a journalist and as a critic, and I didn't know when I started, was that if you want to understand what the jazz scene and cover it, you need to be fluent in Cuban music and you need to understand that connection. So I think some people have this idea of a house of jazz and there's a little anteroom called Latin jazz. And I want to bust that apart right away and say, no, that's not true. These are close brothers or sisters or close cousins. So at La Casita, which is the home of Latin American Studies in affiliation with Syracuse University, is a wonderful place, mm-hmm. run by Terry Paniagua. We're going to have some good food, I'm told. I'm going to sit with Yasvani Terry, who's a brilliant Cuban musician. He's an alto saxophonist. He's a composer. He's also the master of the shekere, the beaded gourd that's used for percussion in Cuba. He's the son of Don Pancho Terry, who was, until his recent death, sort of the acknowledged master of the shekere. And Yasvani is one of the he moved to the U.S. about 20 years ago or so. He's one of the most dynamic musicians on New York scene. He's also a member of the faculty of Harvard, and he directs the jazz ensembles at Harvard. So he's an educator as well. And what we're going to do is we're going to sit and talk about his experiences growing up in Cuba, being exposed to the ritual music, being exposed to the folkloric music, attending those great conservatories, what it was like to come here and dive into the jazz scene here and really tease out these very, very deeply rooted connections between what we call jazz here and what Cuban music is about. And then he's going to perform with his quartet, which really embraces the entire spectrum of what those connections could mean.
In the Wall Street Journal, you wrote, "Reports of jazz's death have been ill-advised, so too have tales of its resurrection." What did you mean when you said that?
I pretty much meant what I said, and that was actually, that was a review of a book called Playing Changes by a very good critic, Nate Chinnan, who was also the editorial director of WBGO's site. And in the book, Nate kind of takes a little walk through the history of people declaring jazz dead and people declaring whoever was that moment's savior for jazz. So, and we've had this each generation or every, so, you know, maybe in the 1980s or 90s, Wynton Marsalis was leading the revolution that was going to reclaim jazz's crown. And in fact, he was on the cover of Time magazine. Earlier, I think maybe Charles Lloyd, when he did an album, Forest Flower, that sold many, many copies, might have been declared something like that.
Joshua Redman in the...
There was a moment with Joshua Redman. Yeah. More recently, Kamasi Washington has been hailed. And, you know, all of these musicians are worthy musicians, and all of the surges of interest and the marketability of their music and the press attention is notable. And, you know, if we're sitting in a marketing department, yeah, you can work that. But I guess what I'm saying there is, you know, I'm playing a little bit off the old Mark Twain quote, but jazz didn't die. It's not going to die. Jazz didn't get reborn or resurrected. I'm more interested in focusing on this deep and vital culture and this deep and vital music that has always been here. And yeah, the market changes, the context changes. And I guess what I mean by that is also, let's not sit and wait for the next savior who's going to make jazz. You know, it's funny, I'm old enough to have endured the little wave. So Ken Burns was going to save jazz, mm-hmm. and he did his PBS series, and hey, he helped sell a bunch of recordings. There's no doubt about that. And he did very well for himself. And people got some jazz funding then. So, you know, there are many good things that happened along that way. But I remember around that time, people were calling jazz America's classical music. They were calling jazz America's indigenous music. How can it be both at the same time? What does that even mean? Mm-hmm. No, it's actually, it's its own form of culture, and maybe not just one style of music, that if we don't look at, hey, is it dead? Hey, is it reborn? Hey, how high is its stock? If we look more at, what does this really mean? What does this really say? And how has it survived and thrived? And, you know, maybe it, first of all, it helps us understand a little bit more about what culture is, but it also helps us understand a little bit more about ourselves and how we survive and thrive based on something more than the 24-hour news cycle or whatever the Dow Jones report is yesterday or whatever we happen to think will happen tomorrow.
If I, as a student or a community individual, attended each of these sessions, what is it that you want me to ultimately walk away with?
I don't want you to walk away with anything. This actually is not transactional. What I want to do is I want to share things that I've learned, things that I've gathered, things that I've written, things that I've thought deeply about, and more than anything else, things that I've gained from my lucky exposure to all these great minds and great talents. And I want to engage everyone that I'm embracing here through this residency in a series of conversations that all lead to one big conversation about culture. So let's all think deeply and in a new way about what we mean by jazz in a far deeper way than, hey, is that song jazz or not? Or, hey, do I want to download some jazz or not? But, hey, I'm living in a country that has a jazz culture. What does that sound like? But also, what does it mean? What can it mean for me? And then beyond that, I'm living in a country that needs to have a culture. Beyond that, how can I participate in that? What does it mean to me? And, you know, there's one thing I want people to take away. I want them to keep the conversations going, with or without me.
For more information and a complete listing of the public events we've been talking about today, you can visit humcenter.syr.edu. We'll also post a link to it on the 315 Facebook page. That's the 315CNY. And in the show notes at waer.org. Larry Blumenfeld, visiting professor in the humanities at Syracuse University, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us a little bit about your time here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.